do a description of all the quantum field excitations that are involved in an atom. It's all rather fascinating. I understand that you can't kind of scare people at the very beginning when they don't understand anything. The problem is that the Bohr atom kind of remains embedded in a lot of people's heads. You know, even very, very smart guys like Dick still kind of intuited that there was some Newtonian mechanics involved in atoms. You know, and we talked about the rotation of electrons and the diameter of electrons and things like that that don't really exist. So I understand that you got to simplify. I mean, I go back to that regularly. A lot of very smart guys will teach people. Some will oversimplify it, in my opinion. Some won't. You got to find that fine line. You could make it understandable to everyone, and it'd be completely wrong. I'll just give you an example that I've used before. Let me drop for a second so I don't time out the machine. Okay? I give you Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking wrote about five different versions of that best-selling book of his, where he describes in layman's terms how Hawking radiation works. And his explanation was complete nonsense and drove at least a few physicists crazy. His original paper on the subject was brilliant and correct. He dumbed it down because he didn't think readers would understand limited case quantum gravity discussions, and so he said something ridiculous like virtual particles and antiparticles came into existence, and one of them went down the black hole and decreased the mass of the black hole. Antimatter and matter have positive mass. They don't have negative mass. There's no particle that you could throw down into a black hole where the mass would decrease rather than increase. So that was complete gibberish on his part, but he wrote it for every single version of that best-selling book because it was easy for people to understand, even though it was incredibly wrong.
Okay. So ultimately, all the models based on quantum mechanics start to exist in 1925, and Schrodinger made it better. So the behavior of hydrogen atoms is explained using wave mechanics to describe atomic orbitals now. I have to ask some students how they are being taught quantum mechanics today. It sounds easy to me, to you. Question is, how many of you and how many of us could be found in the age of 15 years old students, expected?
Well, once again, I will quote Richard Feynman. If you think that you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics.
Absolutely agree. But it's not about understanding. It's about the structure. The reason that we have so much of improvement since the Hadron Collider was built is because of the evolution. So I was pointing about this one single point in evolution where something was known and was thought that is complete and appears to be just a piece. Back to you.
Okay, I mean, all that I was citing was, as far as I was aware, if you open up a science book in a high school, they'll give you the Bohr atom, because that remains the easiest, although highly inaccurate, model to explain things. Usually, quantum mechanics is not something that I think is taught yet in high school. Could be wrong. For the most part, introductory college to physics is classical mechanics, and it isn't only probably until your second year where you touch upon quantum mechanics and other sundry things. You know, there are many engineers who never take a single course in quantum mechanics because 99% of the time they could get away with knowing classical mechanics, and that suffices as a way of looking upon the world, the macro world, without too many problems. It gets you problems if you're designing a GPS system where relativity is involved, but that's unusual. Most of the time, relativity and quantum mechanics doesn't really cause any particular problems. So a lot of engineers, I'm sure, don't even take quantum mechanics.
That's surprising, because in Europe, 12 UFOs are being introduced to quantum mechanics and to exchange.
Well, you know, European education systems are different than American, and I could be completely wrong, because once again, the only real people that I could talk about schools with, my nephew, my niece, graduated 20 years ago. So things could have certainly changed over those years. But as far as I'm aware, most people don't even take physics in high school. I took physics as an advanced course. Usually in my day, back in the ancient time, they wanted you to take two science courses. So you could either take biology and chemistry, or you could take earth science. Earth science was one of those subjects that you took if you didn't really like science. So you took earth science, something like biology, and you had your required science courses for a high school education.
Yeah, it is very much interesting where the education can take you, like a door. In 1998, I landed in Elko, Nevada, and first what I saw was that I was at Murari Gold Mine as president of my own entity with two scientists of mine. And then we were, after the short preparation, signing some papers, taking some tests about safety, we were allowed to go to the underground of that gold mine, because we were acting as the physicists who were called for the problem that the mine had. Let me back. So that was geophysics. They had the steps that were going all around from the underground part of it, deeper and deeper, circularly deeper and deeper, deeper, like a serpentine, deeper, deeper, deeper into the place where they were digging for the gold. So each step was like 50 feet by 50 feet, and all of a sudden such a step was falling down, and nobody knows why. So we had, at that time, the technology that we patented that was looking beneath the ground level to the depth of 1.8 miles, 2 kilometers, 1.6 miles, right? And we were able to see everything that is beneath the ground, every small variation. So if there was a clay and there was gravel, and there was rock, we saw all of those variations, and we had a person who was supervising us from NASA at that time, and everything that we saw, that all experience that was there, was just because of the previous experience and previous education. So physics can open the door to something that you never expected you want to see. How could I expect that I'm going to see the gold mine in the United States of America? Back to you.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, physics is about the universe, why it works, why it does the things it does. So the more you experience the universe with an open eye, an open mind, a couple of textbooks, the more you understand. I've often used the analogy of an onion with many, 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 many layers. Things get more and more complicated the deeper you go. It gets closer and closer to the actual reality, if it ever exists, of the thing. And I'm endlessly amused. I would be disappointed if somehow I knew everything. answers, there would be nothing left to learn.
Thank you very much. It's the time for Space Report. And to XGM.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Thank you for your participation. Thanks for everyone out there for their participation tonight. Please come back next Sunday at 8 when we try and do this all over again. But now it is time for the SpaceNet Report with WS2N. So, Paul, take it away.
Okay, boy. AC2GS, WS2N. And good stories, Wesley. Elk, Nevada. Well, at least you got to see the gold mine in Elk, Nevada. I drove through it. All I got to see was another casino. And all they wanted to do was take my money. So, what are you going to do? The SLS system, the Artemis rocket, looks like it's going to take off on actually Wednesday early morning, very early morning. So, if you're up late Tuesday night at 104 actually, in the morning of Wednesday. That's their planned launch for that rocket. They had a news conference on during this net, so I was multitasking. I have 2 ears. One ear was on the news conference, and the other ear was on Roy talking. But they said that the rocket fared pretty well during that storm that hurricane that went through. You know, they had 100-mile-an-hour winds, but in some locations. But at the rocket location, they have a preset wind speed that they go by. They go up to like the 70-foot level, about the 70-foot level on this 300-foot rocket, and winds and speed, you know, 70. What is it, 74 knots, roughly 85 miles an hour, they said that would be no good. Well, it didn't quite get that high. It got to 80 miles an hour. But they had a little damage, you might call it, to the Orion spacecraft itself. Some RTV filler type, you know, it's like a silicone, apparently blew off. So it sounds like they have that understood, and they probably won't do anything with it to fix it. They would actually have to bring the whole rocket back to the VAV, the Vehicle Assembly Building, and they're going over, you know, all the possibilities. You know, what kind of mass this thing would have if the rocket was going up at, you know, 600 miles an hour. And double off, it would be like, you know, something floating. If you had a car, you know, you just dropped something out of the car, it would be just like floating in air. But yet the car would still be accelerating, and, you know, if it hit something, it could have a problem. That's what caused the Challenger accident. Not, you know, with different stuff, this is different material. So they looked at it, they evaluated it. Apparently they're going to launch anyway, so we'll try to be up for that. I'll report on that next week. Anyway, that's this week. Looking forward to Space Launch System launching for the first time. It's been delayed many times. The first time it rolled out to launch pad was back in March. Since then, they've had a lot of problems. They've had hydrogen leaks and all kinds of problems that they eventually worked through. Figured out how to get around different problems, change out gaskets and stuff. Anyway, they're good to go. It will be a night launch, so the other launches back in September would have been daytime launches, but due to orbital mechanics and where the moon is located, it's going to be a night launch. It looks like a 29-day mission. The original mission would have been around 40 days, again, due to where the moon's located. By the time the spacecraft comes back, it will be returning to the Pacific Ocean early next month. So we'll see how it goes. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, well, again, I'm going to set my recorder for TV. Usually, some of these things never make it to TV, but in the middle of the night, there shouldn't be anything else on, so I guess if I hit CNN or one of the news stations, they should be able to have it on. I know you always get replays on the NASA site. They always have replays of everything that's gone up since we had the internet, I guess. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. They'll go around the moon. They'll orbit I think around 40,000 miles away from the moon. They'll be actually in orbit and come down very close to the moon, I think around 60 miles off the surface, and eventually they'll come back. Now, just today, there is a spacecraft that went into that exact same orbit. It's called the halo orbit of the moon, rectilinear halo orbit. There's a spacecraft called Capstone. Capstone is just, it was launched many months ago. Eventually, it got to the moon. The idea was to pass the moon, go all the way out to around 800,000 miles past the moon. Eventually, the gravity of the moon and Earth would pull it back. And that's what happened to Capstone. It was launched by an electron rocket from New Zealand, by Rocket Lab. It's a small, small spacecraft. It only weighs about 50 pounds. Essentially a CubeSat. They call it a 12U CubeSat. That's the equivalent of 12 CubeSats stuck together. And it's got propulsion on it. It's got solar panels. And it's got a good communications system. And the idea is to put this into the exact same halo type of orbit that eventually the gateway space station will eventually be put into. So they want to check the stability of that orbit. And the reason they want to do that orbit is for a number of reasons, but one would be stability, and really don't need any fuel to keep it going, or very little fuel to keep it in that particular orbit, which will be very important when you have a massive thing like a space station going around the moon. They want to check the orbit and its stability. One way they're going to check that is they're going to communicate with another orbiting satellite that's already in lunar orbit called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's been around, it's been in orbit since 2009. And they know the exact position of that particular spacecraft at all times. They want to do is have this other satellite, this Capstone, actually communicate with it, send data back and forth. They do ranging with that, and then that, once they get that information will transmit back to Earth from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and then they'll match the exact location, compare that with what they see from Earth with their long-range radars, and they want to be able to if they could say that's a great way to do it in the future. If you do have a space station up there, they'll be able to know the exact location all the time using a satellite that's going around the moon. So similar to like their own GPS type of satellite, something that can be multiple satellites like with the GPS system, but just one. They'll be able to do it with only one orbiting satellite. You tell any location of anything that's in this rectilinear orbit. Any comments? WS2N. Okay. Northrop Grumman the other day launched a Cygnus spacecraft on Monday to the International Space Station. And they always name it now. The Cygnus spacecraft, they name it after an astronaut that usually has died, or somebody involved with the space program. And in this case, it was named after Sally Ride. And you might remember that Sally Ride was the first American woman to go into space. Anyway, Cygnus has 8,000 pounds, over 8,000 pounds of cargo experiments that have to get docked with the space station. The problem was with this launch, they have two big round there, solar panels. Each one is like 12 foot in diameter. That open up. After launching, things open up, and you're able to put out like 4,000 kilowatts, you know, equivalent to like a generator you would use for your house. But one of the panels did not open. It was unsuccessful. But, you know, NASA believes in redundancy. They have two panels. They have plenty of power, backup battery power and everything else to make it to the space station. They did that. Eventually, they got close to the space station. Nicole Mann, Nicole is an American astronaut. She got to use the robotic arm, grabbed a hold of it, and attached it to the space station. Pull it berthing, not docking. 16 bolts pulled these two things together eventually. Anyway, that was successful, but yet the one solar panel still did not open. So whether or not they're going to try to open it when it's attached to the space station or not, I don't know. They don't need to. It'll stay attached for months at a time. I think probably in January sometime it will travel back to Earth and eventually burn up in the atmosphere. Take junk and trash away from the space station. But they got their 8,000 pounds worth of food and science equipment and everything else, repair equipment and stuff for the space station. And that number has really increased. I remember when Cygnus first started going up, it was just shy of 4,000 pounds. And now they doubled the amount that they can bring up. They've extended the spacecraft itself. It used to be, it's always been around 14 feet in diameter, and they extended the length over the years. They were able to put more mass and volume into every Cygnus spacecraft that goes up. Now they have enough engines. They're using the RS-181 engines from Russia. They have four more left. They use two on each flight. So they have enough for two more flights, and they go up roughly every, 5 to 6 months. But in a year or so, they're going to deplete that amount of engines, and they're going to need new engines. So they've already contracted with a company called Firefly that is manufacturing engines. They plan on putting seven of them into the booster to replace Russian engines. Naturally, Firefly is built in the United States, and Firefly Company has their facilities in the United States to build these things. They are building their own rocket. In fact, they successfully launched one to orbit last month. So they plan on using the same engines, seven of them, to attach to a future Antares rocket, which launches the Cygnus spacecraft. And that'll be their replacement. But they won't come in time. They're only developing these things. They're going to be short by a couple of, maybe about 4 or 5 months. Anyway, they have plans on temporarily launching on another vehicle. They can launch on the Atlas V if they have to. That's one good thing with Cygnus. They can launch on anything, or they can launch on a SpaceX rocket as well. So they have that capability. Falcon 9 rocket can put a Cygnus cargo vehicle up with no problem. So we'll keep a watch on how this goes. Firefly's engines will be reusable in the future. So at some point, when an Antares rocket launches up from Wallops Island, Virginia, that's where they launch now, eventually someday they'll be returning either to a drone ship or most likely back to a landing facility at Wallops. Now, speaking of Wallops, the Electron rocket that I just mentioned that launched Capstone from New Zealand now has a launch facility also in Wallops Island, Virginia. And they were supposed to launch from there, I guess about 2 years ago. But they got delayed, not from COVID. I know everything is COVID-related, but not that wasn't it. It was the license to do that from the government, from our government. The FAA requires information and extreme details on what would happen if, in this case, an electron rocket being built by a rocket lab happened to go haywire, they lost control of it, and there's a flight termination system. So ground control can do that, if it's going up and they see something that's going wrong, going back to land or something, they can push a button and blow it up. That's fine, but nowadays they require an autonomous system. So it needs to have a computer on board. It's got to be able to say, I'm an electron rocket and I'm going off course. Please blow me up, and it will blow up automatically. And to get that finalized, because all these years, I guess almost 2 years. Anyway, they probably have they now have their license, and they will be launching December, I think it's December 7th, out of Wallops Island for the first American launch. They've launched probably almost 30 of these things from New Zealand so far. But he wants it's Peter Beck, who owns that company, Rocket Lab, needs the capability of launching from not only New Zealand, which he has two launch complexes already built there, but he wants to be able to launch from the United States. So all those rockets, by the way, it's an American company, are being manufactured in the United States. Any comments? I left enough time for Echo Link, but nothing heard. Here's another. Now, by the way, I sent a picture to Roy's website of what the Cygnus spacecraft looks like with only one solar panel open. I also sent pictures of the Lofted mission. The Lofted mission went up the other day, successfully launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. The Atlas V rocket had two satellites on board. One was for the Joint Polar Satellite System, combination of NASA and NOAA, putting a satellite up, for checking out the hurricanes and all of that weather. It'll work in conjunction with the geosynchronous satellites that operate by those. Anyway, that was the main satellite that was put up. But then there was a secondary one mounted underneath that satellite in the fairing, and that was called Lofted. Lofted stands for Low Earth Orbit, a flight test of an inflatable decelerator. Anyway, this inflatable thing was seven rings, large rings, and essentially tubes that inflate with nitrogen, and then that in turn is covered with this heat-resistant, flexible material, and between the two there's all kinds of insulation, and it's packed very tightly inside of a fairing. Now, the biggest diameter heat shield that we make is 16 footer now for the Orion spacecraft, and now this one is going to be 20 feet, and then it's a test type of deal that can actually make it larger. The idea is if you can make it big enough, you could have any kind of payload launch and land places like Mars. You'd be able to bring human equipment and everything down to the Mars surface, no problem with one of these things. The biggest weight that we can right now bring down is 1 ton, 2,000 pounds, which we've done successfully so far with Curiosity and with Perseverance. But if you want to go with anything larger on Mars, something like this would be required, or some gigantic propulsion type of system. But Elon Musk is trying to develop well, this system is better. You know, you don't need all that extra fuel and extra mass. You just inflate one of these things right before you land, and you'll be able to do that. You could also use it on Earth. They plan on eventually using it on some engines, for instance, Vulcan rocket that's going to be going up as B-4 rocket engines being built by Blue Origin. They want them to be reusable on the Vulcan rocket as well. They'd be able to launch your rocket, inflate one of these inflatable heat shields, and bring it back successfully. Anyway, it launched successfully with the Joint Polar Satellite System the other day, and did a couple of orbits and came back north of Hawaii as planned. And flying through the atmosphere at 17,500 miles an hour, first it inflated to like 16 pounds per square inch. It's got two big nitrogen tanks on top. It was launched by the Atlas V. The main booster, of course, went away. They separated the Joint Polar Satellite System. That went to its orbit, and then this thing was left attached to the second stage with the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, second stage. At that point, it inflated. Once it inflated, it separated from the second stage. Now it was on its own, flying through the atmosphere, heated up to many thousands of degrees, probably around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and came through the atmosphere, slowed itself down to, I think it was Mach 0.7, they said. So, slower than the speed of sound. Parachutes came out. And then as it came down closer to the water in the Pacific, it launched a module that's been doing all the recording of the telemetry and pictures and everything. A tremendous amount of data is on this one module, and that winds up floating in the ocean. They had like 8-foot seas. It was pretty rough, too. I did see this live. And a lot of telemetry was coming down, radio, transmitting, but nothing like what's going to be on this module. So the goal of this ship, it was a ship that left Hawaii 2 days before the launch. It was a good sized crew on it. It's got this big flat surface in the back of the ship, and they had built a fan for to be able to receive this lofted test vehicle. It came down. Accuracy was terrific, very close to the ship. Inside of a half hour, they had a crane on board the ship. They pulled this whole thing out of the sea, put it onto the stand, and then it looked perfect, by the way. I did send a picture of what it looked like from space. That's on Roy's website as well. I didn't see what it looked like when it was sitting in the ship. It was nighttime anyway, so it was tough to see it. They said it was in perfect shape. Perfect shape. I mean, everything worked. It's a complicated thing of opening up this, thing with nitrogen coming through the atmosphere with parachutes. It's just remarkable technology. And I just wonder if Elon Musk will eventually take use of this thing, send a rocket to Mars, but if this propulsion thing of trying to land that thing on Mars, I think he's really stretching the ability of what he's going to be able to do. But one of these inflatable things, no problem. I think it's very, very good technology, and it was very successful. By the way, that module that came flying out with all the data, which was the size, designed to float. After they picked up the heat shield, they floated over to wherever this thing was and picked that up as well. And all in, like I said, 8-foot seas. Amazing. And let's see, any comments? WS1. Nothing heard. One other quick topic.
I'm really bummed that the
X-37B
is now not going to take place on her birthday.
Space plane came back to Earth after flying in orbit for 908 days. So that's a record. The X-37B was developed by our government, not NASA. No NASA money is involved with this. But it's, all military government money. So it's on the top secret side. First launch was back in 2010 in April. They own two of these vehicles. They were able to go into orbit, do whatever they got to do, probably spy type of satellite, who knows. Again, top secret.
That time. Complete.
Got Delta wings on there. And, the first flight was a couple hundred days, but now they're up to 900 days with these things. So as one comes back, the other one launches, and this one came back to Florida. People in Florida could hear the sonic boom. The earlier ones used to come back and land in at Edwards Air Force Base in California, and then they used to ship it across the country. This one came back over here, back to Florida, landed on the same 3-mile runway that the shuttle used to land on. Came back from a couple of sonic booms in the middle of the night. They said they woke up half of southern Florida, but it worked out well. And again, if you want to see what the X-37 looks like, an actual picture of this was after it landed. Again, it was a nighttime flight, but you can see it quite clearly. I sent it over again to roy.ac2gs. .com, the website. That's it. I hit the magic hour at 11 o'clock, so we'll pass back to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night. Tomorrow night's Clubnet and all. Day 73, and have a good night. Roy, back to you. AC2GS, WS2M.
Thank you, Paul. You actually doubled with Frank. In the old days, EchoLink couldn't do that, but I guess it's wired in a wonky way. So maybe if you let it drop for a little bit longer, Frank will have a better chance of actuating the repeater.
Will do. Hello, Frank.
Hi. Probably my fault, David, but it took me a minute to hit the tap the right button on the phone. In any case, it was nothing important, but I just wanted to express how bummed I am that the Artemis launch has changed and will no longer occur on my birthday at very close to the exact time of my birth now, 2 days later. Anyway, 7-3, have a good night. Talk this evening.
Dead, Frank. Drop dead. Very good, Frank. And happy birthday. And two more days. By the way, one of the satellites that we just sent up triangulates signals. Wonderful thing. And its main purpose is to find problems, usually for the military or any organization. They can find any kind of signal. They're getting good at this stuff. Back to you, Roy. WS to us. 73, Frank.
Okay, very good. Paul, thanks for the SpaceNet report. Thanks for all that you do for the technical net, and thanks for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you'll come back and join us again next week, Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. I always like to remind you that Zig K2REW ended his technical net with the advice to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. It's especially good advice now. We live in dangerous times in many ways. So be safe and help each other. Help your friends. Help your family. Help your enemies, too. They deserve to survive. So be well. Stay safe. Also, I'd like to pop up this quote again from Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open and learn something new every day. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. Be well, stay safe. This is AC2GS, and I'll be clear.
Go put your face in shit, Roy.
time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Whiskey Bravo 2, Mike Sierra Bravo, mobile listening.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
NQT, you are listening for Mount Vernon, New York. Anybody copy?
Flymark InfoNet, tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL.
Y2H.
He's sounding marginally better.
All right, well, still congested. So I guess you're just starting out.
Yeah, I got to make some stops in between, and I told Pat I'm shooting for around 10-ish. So just got to see what happens. Going to try getting gas, stopping at KRP for a minute to see if they have a connector.
All righty, well, I'll be here.
Oh, I knew that. Trying to recover.
The ARCOM in plain view is in a sad shape. The audio is gone. So I switched over to Morse ID, at least, so or at least we're legal. But I have one here, and we have one in Middle Island. Now, the one in Middle Island we know doesn't play well with the All-Star. I have one here, but I have nothing to test it with yet. I got to make some connectors or whatever. And if I get this one working, then I can try to reflash the other one. I know Eric always had a problem when ARCOM came out with new firmware. I'm a little reluctant to try that as step one, but we shall see.
Well, I know the one that you have, which has the audio delay board in it, I had working with the repeater that's currently in Middle Island before you swapped it.
So maybe I had an issue with this one also, with the ARCOM. I don't know. According to Kevin, it's hit and miss with these ARCOMs and All-Stars. But nobody seems to know why.
I can't tell you.
Did you go to the... Oh, yes, you went to the AmFest. I was feeling lousy, so I just stayed home and rested. But how was the turnout?
It was fairly good. It wasn't... I mean, I've seen it jammed up a lot worse, but there was a certainly reasonable amount of people that showed up.
Enough to keep the vendors happy.
You're asking the wrong person. I was sitting with Steve most of the time, but there certainly was enough people walking around.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because Ken, KWC, was making announcements over the repeater, talking up the ham fest, giving the address, etc. I don't know if they've done that in the past or not. But, okay. So what does Steve have to say? Anything new? Anything startling? Anything antenna-wise over at Glen Oaks?
No, just that he's dropped the two spare antennas over there. The one for the receive and the one for the link. And they're sitting there, and he's trying to hook up with Bill so he can be there when Bill's there.
Yeah, I want to install a remote SDR receiver up there, which will allow me to get on the computer and tune VHF and UHF. It basically will be a way for me to monitor some of the more obscure repeaters we have, like the 220 and the 1.2 gig, because I can't get them from out here. So that should be pretty easy to do. Is NY2H?
Okay. Anyway, if you'll pardon me, I'm just pulling up to the gas station here. Let's see, what are we today? Regular is 345 and premium is up to 418. Well.
And the fuel companies are posting exceptional profits. Apparently it's not all inflation. A little bit of corporate greed thrown in.
No doubt. Alright.
Talk to you later. NY2H.
Okay. WB2GS. WB2GS. Thank you.
Skymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Here is WB2EAV listening.
About a little stiff, but not bad.
Ooh, me too. Oh, you know, I just thought of something. I gotta make a quick phone call. You just reminded me. I told Pat I'd get my call. WB2Z, stand by.
Okie dokie.
So here I am. WB2Z, I think.
Going up in front of the drugstore here.
Well, I'll let you go inside. I'll be on for a little while. I'm just headed east. Just going up the sack to go south.
All right. We'll see what happens. All depends on how long I get stuck here. W2OSR.
W2OSR.
W1EMR. Good morning.
I know good and morning belong in the same sentence. How are you feeling today?
Right, I forgot today is Monday, and for working people, it's the start of the work week, which isn't always agreeable.
Well, I'm not working. I'm heading up to Levittown for my chiropractor, but I'm not a morning person.
All right, I've been up since 5:30 this morning, so I understand. All right, hope all goes well with the whatever treatment you're getting.
Yeah, the chiropractor just cracked me up.
All right, at least you got a sense of humor about it.
If we can't last ourselves, you know, we got to beat everybody else to it, right?
Yeah, I wound up in the hospital yesterday, and I had to say it was the first time I had my head examined. That's only because they put me through a CAT scan.
If they examined my head, I don't think they'd let me out.
Yeah, it's a good thing they can't read minds.
Affirmative. Hopefully the meds they gave me are knock it out real quick.
Yeah, I know. I just had to go up and pick up some meds. Amongst other things that were going on, I wound up with some sort of an infection. I got to take an antibiotic to get rid of it.
A few weeks ago, I had the trifecta, a quadfecta, a kidney stone, a problem with the fistula. I had teeth problems. I was and a foot problem. I was falling apart. I didn't know how I was going to survive that week. But the kidney stone's not fun.
Oh, I fully know that. I've had them two times. And I know once I was
Actually, when I was going to school at night, I didn't know I had the stone, and I was passing it. And I came home in the car screaming my lungs out because I was in so much pain.
The first time I had him, I was in Glen Oak. I was driving my cell phone. I'm like, I'm not going to the hospital. I'm not going to the hospital. I got home. And I ended up calling one of my friends, one of the ambulances, and they took me back to the hospital. Yeah. Sometimes you get stubborn. I'm stubborn.
Yeah, well, what happened yesterday is, yesterday morning, coming out the front door, to grab the newspaper out of the driveway, and it fell down, so I banged myself up a little bit. That left me with a stiff knee, and then I'm sitting there at the Limar campus, and I'm feeling like crap, so I went back, I got something to drink, made me feel a little bit better, but all the guys around me said, hey, we're taking you to the hospital, we're making sure there's nothing really wrong.
I know, I was one of those guys.
Okay, well, oh, is this Marty?
Martin, yes. Yes, and we even need to patch your car back up.
Okay, thank you, guys. Yeah, I didn't catch the call sign because you were kind of weak when you first came in. Now I realize that.
I'm just happy everything turned out okay.
Yeah, what it wound up to be was, I guess I was just starting with a UTI, urinary tract infection. I haven't had one of those in about 4 years now, so I was kind of surprised. Oh, there goes my wife. Hang on a second. No, I was just passing my wife here in the street, going out somewhere, and she told me Jeff called to see if I was still alive.
And that's probably how he said it, too.
And knowing him, that's quite possible. It looks like somebody was going through my recycle bin here to get cans today.
If they're going to do it, at least make it neat.
The two of the people that come by are nice. They put the cover back on the can.
Then it's not so bad. Some of them just make a mess.
Exactly. Oh, well. I am home. I am feeling better. I got my antibiotic from the drugstore just now, and you know, I'm hobbling around a little bit with the stiff knee, but other than that, I could be in a lot worse shape, so I'm happy.
Hey, if you can do it, either a hot shower on the knee or a hot bath, that will help loosen it up a little bit.
I already did that this morning. Take care, 73W2OSR, and once again, thank you.
No problem anytime. W1EMR stuck in the Bell Park lot.
W1EMR, NY2H.
Good. John, if you use my own thing. Just say good morning, but good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm starting my fourth week on this virus, which isn't going away completely. Kind of like a head cold now. Other than that, just peachy keen.
I'm having